arsons amount to war crimes, holding the regime responsible for the mass burial of at Gaza's Nasser Hospital. The Hezbollah resistance movement shoots down an Israeli Hermes 450 drone over southern Lebanon after it violated the country's airspace. And two major American military bases in eastern Syria come under missile and drone attacks amid simmering anti-US sentiments across the region. Thank you for joining us. Palestinians continue to endure a US-Israeli genocidal war on the besieged Gaza Strip, the scene of death and destruction on a daily basis. In the latest attack, Israeli warplanes targeted two residential buildings in Rafah City, killing 19 Palestinians, including 14 children. The Ministry of Health in Gaza reports that some 48 Palestinians were killed and 79 others were injured in Gaza in the past 24 hours. That brings up the total number of victims since October the 7th to more than 34,000. The number of those wounded has also risen to almost 77,000. On Saturday, the Palestinian Civil Defense said bodies of over 200 Palestinians buried by Israel in a mass grave were recovered inside Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. From Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, Moti Abu Musabeh joined us earlier for more on the mass graves uncovered in the Nasser Hospital.
More heinous crimes are unfolding every moment here in the Gaza Strip, particularly in Khan Yunis city, whereas at least three mass graves were discovered over the last couple of hours in less than 24 hours inside the yards of the Nasser Medical Complex, including at least 210 Palestinian dead bodies. Those dead bodies were kidnapped and abducted inside the Nasser Medical Complex, and they were executed in cold blood by the Israeli occupation forces during their ground offensive against the Nasser Medical Complex over the last couple of months. According to Gaza civil defense crews, that at least 500 Palestinian civilians are estimated to be missed and buried in the same and still trapped under the rubble of those destroyed houses and the rubble of the facilities in Khan Yunis city. So we are facing more atrocities committed against the Palestinian people, and these atrocities actually present another substantial evidence on the brutality and the cruelty of the Israeli occupation forces when it comes to the Palestinian people. The vast majority of those dead bodies actually were extracted, and they were found actually blindfolded and handcuffed, which means that they were executed in cold blood by the Israeli occupation forces after being kidnapped and abducted. As I've mentioned, that according to Gaza civil defense crews, that at least 2,000 Palestinian civilians are estimated forcibly disappeared till this moment over the repetitive attacks against multiple areas in the Gaza Strip.
Iran holds Israel responsible for the massacre and mass burial inside Gaza's Nasser Hospital, saying the states supporting the regime are also accountable for the crime. The foreign ministry spokesman urged the UN chief, the rotating president of the Security Council, and the entire international community to condemn the horrific incident in Khan Yunis. Nasser Kanani also called for tapping into national, regional, and international potential to prosecute the culprits behind the crime perpetrated at the hospital. Kanani underlined that Israel's systematic and extensive massacres of Gazans clearly amount to genocide and war crimes. The recovery of over 200 bodies from a mass grave inside the Nasser Medical Complex has also drawn condemnation from Hamas. The resistance movement says the discovery of the mass grave proves the extent of the Israeli crimes and atrocities being committed against Palestinians. Hamas says the horrific crimes would have been impossible without Washington's backing for Israel. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the Israeli regime and its acts of aggression are the root causes of insecurity in the region. Amir Abdollahian made the comment during a phone conversation with his Finnish counterpart Elina Valtonen on Sunday. He said the Islamic Republic is not seeking tension in West Asia, adding that regional peace requires a right stance and an end to the West double standards. The top Iranian diplomat also called for collective efforts to help end the genocidal war on Gaza urging European governments to stop arming Israel. The Finnish foreign minister said on her part that the continuation of tensions in the region is not in the interest of anyone, adding that her country condemns any move that escalates the situation. She also said that Finland wants an immediate ceasefire in Gaza without preconditions. Palestinians have joined a general strike across the occupied West Bank in condemnation of the massacre carried out by Israeli forces in the Nur Shams refugee camp. Our correspondent Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
After almost 3 days, the Israeli forces withdrew from the refugee camp of Nur Shams near the city of Tul Karim in northern occupied West Bank. Only then paramedics were able to evacuate the martyrs' bodies and the families were able to count their dead. Over a dozen Palestinians have been killed since Thursday, but the number might be higher, as reports suggest that Israeli forces had confiscated the bodies of more martyrs. On Sunday, a comprehensive general strike was declared across the occupied West Bank to mourn Tul Karim martyrs. Scores of Palestinians also held a protest in the center of Ramallah against Israel's escalation and violence in Tul Karim and Nur Shams refugee camp.
Israel is expanding its genocide into the West Bank as well. And as we said before, there is no safe place for any Palestinian. And there has to be immediate Palestinian unity to stand up to this terrible aggression. And there has to be international boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign worldwide. And there has to be condemnation.
It's obvious that the Palestinian people, leadership and factions have to declare an immediate comprehensive popular uprising all over the Palestinian territories until the Israeli occupation ends. The ongoing war of attrition is no longer useful, but what's necessary is a national popular uprising.
The Israeli invasion has caused some of the worst destruction in the West Bank in decades. The occupation forces destroyed infrastructure, including sewage lines, shops, homes, and vehicles. Homes were turned into interrogation centers, and dozens of Palestinians were arrested. According to locals, heavy exchange of fire and clashes took place between resistance fighters and Israeli soldiers during the operation. The Israeli military admitted that at least 9 of its soldiers were wounded.
The Israeli occupation regime is escalating its violence against the Palestinian people. Its crimes are meant to exterminate the Palestinian people. In Gaza, genocide is being committed, and here in the West Bank, there are daily incursions, murders, collective punishment, and destruction everywhere. The Israeli occupation is doing its utmost to either bring Palestinians to their knees or commit more aggression and crimes against them.
Sunday's general strike paralyzed all aspects of life in the West Bank, with shops, schools, universities, and banks shuttered. But Palestinians question whether such a standstill is enough, expressing fear that once the Israeli military is done with Gaza, the occupied West Bank could be next. The Israeli military's violence against Palestinians is aimed at countering resistance, people here say. This is part of the Israeli crackdown on armed groups in the occupied West Bank. However, Palestinians say the Israeli crimes, including in the Nur Shams refugee camp, have failed to weaken their determination. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has shot down an Israeli drone over an area in southern part of the country. Hezbollah said the targeted drone is Hermes 450, adding that the operation was carried out in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The group has downed and intercepted several Israeli drones in recent months. The Lebanese resistance movement and the Israeli military have been trading fire since October the 8th, a day after the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza. Hezbollah fires missiles and rockets at Israeli military sites in northern occupied territories, while Israel targets residential areas in southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, two U.S. military bases in Syria have come under fresh missile and drone attacks amid growing anti-American sentiment in the region. Lebanese media reports say 4 missiles hit the Al-Omar oil field base, while 3 missiles and a drone targeted the Kharab al-Jir base. Both facilities are located in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. No group has yet claimed responsibility, but Reuters, citing security sources, said 5 rockets were fired from the Iraqi town of Zumar towards northeastern Syria without giving further detail. U.S. military facilities and bases in Syria have come under repeated attacks in recent months. Resistance groups in Iraq and elsewhere are outraged at the U.S. military presence in the region, which they say is a source of instability, as well as Washington's support for the Israeli regime in its ongoing genocidal war on Gaza. A European NGO has called for investigations into the role of major technology companies and international social media platforms in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor said those companies must be held accountable if they're found to be complicit in the crime. According to the Euromed, those firms will also be needed to hold into account in case of their failure to prevent access to users' information and its exploitation. The Geneva-based group pointed to frequent reports that Israel uses a number of artificial intelligence-supported technological systems to illegally track and monitor Palestinians. The NGO said it has been recently revealed that the U.S. tech giant Google and Israel are collaborating on several technology initiatives. The Euromed's call comes as UN experts warned earlier this month that Israel's use of AI in Gaza is leading to an unprecedented toll on civilian population and infrastructure. And last but not least, to end the bulletin, earlier in our news review program, we discussed the significance of Iran's retaliatory operation against Israel, hailed by the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
It's news review time. The leader of the Islamic Revolution says Iran's retaliatory operation against Israel demonstrated its resolve internationally. Ayatollah Khamenei said that the establishment of this willpower is what has angered the enemy. The leader made the comments while meeting with Iran's top military commanders. He hailed the armed forces for giving a good impression of their capacities and power and a commendable image of the Iranian nation. Ayatollah Khamenei was referring to the massive missile and drone strikes against Israel after regime's deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Now, I'm inviting two guests to discuss this a bit more. Hakime Safavi-Biri is an academic and political analyst in Tehran. Farokh Sekalashvar, Islamic scholar, joining me from Qom. Good to have you both. Beginning with Hakime, tell us your assessment of all this media propaganda, especially in the West, trying to undermine this, you know, showing some images that Iran has hit just some, has caused some minor damage here and there, and whereas Iran had already said that this is only a warning, it was not meant for destruction. That's what Iran has actually done.
Iran was not aiming at destroying Israel on that night, but that to show its determination and its resolve to take action whenever needed. And at this time, the idea was to hit, the place that was, used for committing the act of terror against the Iranian consulate. So actually was done. So I think it is important to understand that what we are witnessing today is seeing Iran's capabilities, on the ground. We are seeing Iran's resolve to take action whenever needed and at the right time with the right amount of power. And I think the people of the world, and especially those who are concerned about the plight of the Palestinians, those who are concerned about the continuation of the genocide that's happening in Palestine, the continuation of Israeli atrocities all around the region, basically against different targets, including Iranian targets, are happy with what they have seen.
Okay. Now let me move to city of Qom. Farokh, Iran had already given warnings, and that on multiple occasions, not once and once and twice. And there were some who were saying that Iran is only talking about this, it will never take action, but Iran did take action, as it had a warning, it had warned already. So let our viewers know what message this action conveys to both the adversaries and ill-wishers of the Islamic establishment.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. The first point was that the power of deterrence that the Israeli regime supposed to have had proved out to be a spider web deterrence. And this in itself was their greatest defeat, and the whole world saw this. Before this, such a deterrence was keeping them at least mentally ahead, and it was looming over the Muslim masses. But alhamdulillah, Iran, the most important thing, with Allah's permission, that they did was to not only show their capabilities, but in addition to that, ruin and put an end to the deterrence that they had, and show to the world that this was nothing. It was all imagination, and they have nothing. And for the Muslim masses, there's nothing to fear. This was the greatest defeat.
Thank you, my guests, Hakim Safavi in Tehran and Farooq Sekalashvar in the city of Qom.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Gaza still amazes the world with its incredible resistance despite all forms of oppression it has been facing since the start of the brutal Israeli regime aggression on October 7th. Both people and resistance stand firm in the face of the Israeli massacres and deliberate starvation. The Zionist regime's attacks continued recently in several areas across the besieged enclave, with the concentration was on the Gaza Strip center. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, on the first day of the Muslim Eid al-Fitr, on April 11th, the Zionist regime army announced the beginning of a military operation in the central Gaza Strip, particularly in the Nusayrat refugee camp. Scores of people were murdered and hundreds injured, including children, in the continued Israeli regime airstrikes and artillery shelling. Just as it has happened in other areas of Gaza, the Zionist regime forces targeted civilian infrastructure, homes, schools, and even mosques. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with four residents of the camp who shared their testimonies on the horrific Israeli regime invasion. Ali al-Jodeili told the Palestine Chronicle, on the very first day of their incursion, Israeli occupation forces bombed two schools operated by UNRWA, two mosques, and dozens of homes. The two mosques destroyed were the Mu'adh ibn Jabal Mosque, located at the northern entrance of Nusayrat, and Zulnairan Mosque, located in the northwestern area of the camp. But they did not stop there. On the fourth day of its ongoing operation, the Israeli army also destroyed the Hassan al-Banna Mosque, the oldest mosque in the new area of the Nusayrat refugee camp. Ahmad al-Ghoreinawi is a resident of Nusayrat. He was particularly attached to the mosque. Al-Ghoreinawi told Palestine Chronicle, the occupation destroyed Hassan al-Banna Mosque, which houses the Muhammad School for Quran Memorization, attended by over 400 children. He explained, The Banna Mosque also included a football field with artificial turf, inaugurated about 2 years ago, and a large scientific library always filled with students. The occupation has deprived children and students of one of the most important places for education and recreation in Nuseirat. During the 6 months of genocidal war on Gaza, the child-killing regime of Israel has also systematically targeted schools. According to the latest figures provided by the Palestinian Ministry of Education, at least 378 schools were destroyed and damaged in Gaza. Additionally, at least 4,327 students, at least 231 teachers and 94 professors were murdered. Fatima Mohammed told the Palestine Chronicle that she was shocked when she learned that Israel had completely destroyed her children's school. She said, "My children, Mohammed and Ahmad, used to study at Malaysian Quranic School, located north of the Nuseirat camp, but Israel bombed it and destroyed it, depriving my children of their place of learning. My children loved their school very much, and they were traumatized when they found out what had happened." She said, "I hesitated before breaking the news to them, but I also wanted my children to understand the crimes of the occupation and to be aware of the war it is waging against everything and everyone in Gaza." Muhammad Abu Al-Raous works as a teacher at the Malaysian Quranic School. He told the Palestine Chronicle the school was located on the outskirts of the Nuseirat camp, and there were no buildings around it, so there is no justification for the bombing. "The truth is, the occupation aims to destroy all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip to punish its residents for their refusal to migrate," Al-Raous added, saying, "Also, by bombing schools, the occupation tries to deprive future generations of their right to education, but it will not succeed. We will teach our children in tents, under the sun, and anywhere else. We are determined to raise an educated and informed Palestinian generation capable of resisting the occupation and exposing its crimes in all international forums." According to Wafa News Agency, Palestinian media reported attacks on two mosques, a UN-run school and a Malaysian school in the Nuseirat refugee camp recently. Also in central Gaza, several residential homes and a market were subjected to Israeli regime strikes. Elsewhere in northern Gaza, the Faras market was targeted. Strikes were also reported in the southern city of Rafah, according to Palestinian media. Health Ministry in Gaza reported that 68 people were murdered and 94 others were injured in seven massacres in the past 24 hours. It has put the death toll of the Israeli regime aggression on the Gaza Strip at least 34,000 people. The ministry added that the number of injured people reached at least 76,094. Meanwhile, Civil Defense in Gaza said on its Telegram channel that it recovered 13 more decomposing bodies in Khan Yunis, Al-Balad and Al-Amal neighborhoods. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described the destruction in the southern city of Khan Yunis as profound. In a post on X, the UN Office said, "A team has visited Khan Yunis and witnessed destroyed homes, schools and hospitals, as well as unexploded ordnance." Music.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, free yourself from those chains in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So yes, we have a long title on the program today on A to Z, and that is free yourselves from the chains that are shackling you down as a part of our Islamic lifestyle and living our Islamic lifestyle. So what in the world are we talking about? Well, let's kind of break it up into separate pieces so that it's easier to understand for you and for me. So we're talking about living a Islamic lifestyle, first and foremost. So as a part of living a Islamic lifestyle, you know, we should not live a un-Islamic lifestyle. Make sense? Or are we more confused now than we were before? Well, perhaps we're a little bit more confused. Now, when we're talking about not living, that means we do not want to live a life which is un-Islamic, right? And so that is one side of the coin. That means that we start to get rid of things which are un-Islamic. And on the other hand, we are trying to achieve that ultimate Islamic lifestyle. So that means that we need to inculcate and work on implementing things into our life which are Islamic. So these are the first two coins as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Now, the other thing which is a part of this incredibly long title that we're talking about is to free ourselves from the chains that are shackling down, and that is something that we're going to talk about in the next segment. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how this Islamic lifestyle has two sides to it. The one side is to implement and inculcate Islamic things into our lifestyle. And the other side of that coin was to get rid of un-Islamic things that are unfortunately, have become a part of our lifestyle. But now, the last thing that we want to talk about, which is part of our title, is to, you know, free ourselves from these shackles that are chaining us down. You know, sometimes we have the wrong perspective on what is a burden, right? A burden is something that it weighs you down. It's a shackle. It keeps you chained. We have the wrong aspect on what is thing is a burden and what thing is not a burden. And it comes back to what we consider to be Islamic and what we consider to be not Islamic. And, you know, and within Islamic, what do we consider to be important and valuable and what we don't. So, for example, you know, we think that prayers, salah, the five daily prayers, is a burden, when in reality that is something that frees us from the shackles. So what are shackles? Greed, jealousy, lust, carnal desires, I don't know, you know, and a lot of them kind of revolve around all of these things, right? Pride and arrogance, and these are the things which chain us down, and these are the things that we need to free ourselves from. And I guarantee you that when you overcome something like greed, or you overcome something like arrogance, or you overcome other kind of, you know, Islamically delineated moral and ethical vices, when you overcome them, you will feel a sense of true divine power as well as freedom from these things that shackle us down. And so an integral part of our Islamic lifestyle is to free ourselves from these shackles that are chaining us down.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
In New York, United States, the first seven jurors have been seated in Donald Trump's trial as the judge warns the former president about his comments. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Seven Manhattan residents were selected to serve on the jury in former President Donald Trump's criminal trial on Tuesday, 16th of April, as lawyers for both sides clashed over which potential jurors should be seated and the judge warned the defendant to remain quiet. During the selection process, the anonymous members of the jury were known only by their letters and numbers. There are four men and three women, ranging from young to middle-aged. They include a salesman, a nurse, two lawyers, and an IT consultant, a teacher, and a software engineer. They all answered questions about their background and their opinion of Donald Trump before they were chosen to serve on the jury as one of the highest-profile trials in American history. One member of the jury, a nurse, said she doesn't really have an opinion of the former president. She promised that she's here for my civic duty and to listen to the facts. The IT consultant said, "My family is my hobby," and admitted to finding Trump fascinating and mysterious. The teacher said she had friends with strong opinions of Donald Trump, but added that she's not very interested in politics or the news. "President Trump speaks his mind, and I'd rather than that someone who's in office, who you don't know what they're thinking," she said. She was not aware that Donald Trump faces criminal charges in other cases. The jurors were advised by Judge Juan Merchan to plan on returning for opening statements on Monday, 22nd of April. Judge Juan Merchan said the court would let them know if that plan changes. At least five more jurors plus another half a dozen alternates must still be chosen. Roughly 80 people have been excused since questioning began on Monday. Most of them said they could not be impartial in deciding a case involving Donald Trump. Others were dismissed based on their answers to questions about their political beliefs or social media posts. Six of the jurors were selected and sworn in together earlier in the afternoon. A seventh juror was added after further questioning of another batch of potential members. The jury selection process will resume on Thursday, 18th of April. A dispute over one potential juror's Facebook post showing celebrations after Trump lost the 2020 election prompted audible comments from the former president on Tuesday. That earned him an admonishment from Judge Juan Merchan, who told Donald Trump's attorney Todd Blanche to speak to his client. "Mr. Blanche, your client was audibly uttering something. He was audible, gesturing and speaking in the direction of the juror. I won't tolerate that," the judge said. "I will not have any jurors intimidated in my courtroom. I want to make that crystal clear." Todd Blanche had asked the judge to dismiss the juror over the video post, which showed people cheering in the streets of New York. The woman told the court that she wanted to capture a New York City celebratory moment, likening the cheers to nightly celebrations for healthcare workers during the COVID-19 pandemic. She insisted that she could remain impartial during the trial. The judge initially said she provided reasonable explanations for both posts, but she was ultimately dismissed. He also excused another man who had posted about Donald Trump's unlawful travel ban and wrote, "Get him out and lock him up." Those disputes came after prosecutors and defense attorneys got their first chance to directly question potential jurors who made it past the first round of screening. Earlier, Joshua Steinglass, a member of the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office, told the jurors that the case has nothing to do with your politics. "We don't suggest you need to have been living under a rock for the last 8 years or the last 30 years," he said. "You don't expect you not to have heard about this or not to have discussed this case with your friends. What we do need from you is to keep an open mind." Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president, is charged with 34 state felony counts of falsification of business records related to a hush money payment that his attorney made to a film actress Stormy Daniels before the 2016 presidential election. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges, claiming the prosecution is part of a plot by Democrats aimed at preventing him from retaking the White House. The case is the first of four criminal prosecutions against Donald Trump to make it to trial. Entering the courtroom on Tuesday, 16th of April, Donald Trump called the trial a sham and said the charges should have been dismissed. "This is a trial that should never happen. It should have been thrown out a long time ago," he told reporters. At several points during Monday morning's arguments, Donald Trump appeared to fall asleep at the defense table, his chin dropping to his chest briefly. In one instance, he was stirred awake by his attorney. He appeared to doze off at several points again on Tuesday. The trial is expected to last between 6 and 8 weeks, convening every weekday except Wednesdays. Donald Trump is required to attend the trial. The schedule severely limits Trump's ability to hit the campaign trail, which he has cited to support his claims of political bias. Donald Trump said on Tuesday, "I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states like North Carolina and Georgia. I should be campaigning." CNN cable news network has also covered the same story and tells us more. Seven jurors have been selected in the second day of Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial, which concluded on Tuesday with the selection of seven jurors. A panel of 12 New Yorkers and likely six alternates will ultimately be chosen. The trial will resume on Thursday, 18th of April. The judge, Juan Merchan, has reprimanded the former president, Donald Trump. Judge Juan Merchan on Tuesday gave the former president a stern warning for visibly and audibly reaching to one of the potential jurors. "I will not have any jurors intimidated in my courtroom," he said. Donald Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records for his alleged role in a hush money scheme before the 2016 presidential election. Trump has pleaded not guilty. Trump is the first former president in U.S. history to go to criminal trial. His legal challenges come as he juggles the campaign and courtroom as the 2024 presumptive GOP nominee. Donald Trump is expected, after court, to stop at a Manhattan bodega where an employee stabbed a man in a 2022 incident that sparked backlash against Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Alvin Bragg is currently leading the hush money case against the former president. Jose Alba was a worker at what is now called the Sanar convenience store in Upper Manhattan in July of 2022. When he was charged with second-degree murder after stabbing a man who came behind the counter and shoved him. Jose Alba and his lawyers argued that he acted in self-defense, and the charges were later dismissed amid a backlash to Alvin Bragg's decision to charge him. Donald Trump is expected to talk about crime and inflation, according to the poll covering the former president's visit.
Deterrent.
Part 3.
In the early hours of the morning of Wednesday, the 8th of January, 2020, 13 Iranian missiles destroyed the Ain al-Assad U.S. military base in Iraq. Before the attack, U.S. President Trump had warned that if Iran attacks U.S. interests, Washington will target 52 sites in the country. And people across the world have for long wondered why the U.S. did not respond to Iran's missile attack. The advance and upgrade of the Shahab generation liquid-fueled missile by Iranian scientists in the early 2000s led to the production of Iran's first long-range missile. Improving the range of missiles is one of the most important factors in the missile industry, and Iranians are well aware of that. The Qadr missile, an upgraded version of the Shahab, was designed and mass-produced in three classes, S, H, and F. The new series of the precision-guided missiles, which have detachable warheads, are capable to provide Iranian forces with the ability to respond to any possible attack by the Israeli regime from anywhere in Iran because of their greater range. Unlike liquid-fueled missiles, in which Iran had used reverse engineering to design and produce locally, the field of solid fuel was essentially domestic technology. Solid fuel was very important to Iranian missile experts. Solid fuel is extremely advantageous because it has a longer storage time, takes less time to prepare, and speeds up missiles. Upgrading the range of Zelzal rockets and equipping them with guidance and control systems led to the transformation of the rockets into missiles. This was a huge step in solid fuel technology. The Zelzal missile, even with a one-ton warhead, has been mass-produced in various classes. It strikes with high velocity and can be mounted on multiple launch systems. It is capable of delivering hellfire to any heavy weaponry up to 270 kilometers away. In the beginning of 2001, a project called Ashura kickstarts to improve the range of solid-fueled missiles. After years of efforts, Iranian scientists and engineers succeed in achieving the project's goal. November 2008, the Sajil missile was successfully tested and its production line was launched in a short period of time. The Sajil is in fact Iran's first solid-fueled missile, which uses a two-stage booster system and has a range of 2,000 kilometers. There are good reasons to call this Iron Giant Iran's most deadly missile. Its initial high acceleration practically takes away the enemy's ability to shoot it down.
But in the final stage, the landing speed of this huge missile as it strikes reaches 4,300 meters per second. This turns Israel's defense shield, known as the Iron Dome, into a flimsy dome against these missiles. As efforts were made to deliver solid and liquid fuel missiles to their targeted ranges, another strategic policy in Iran's missile industry was being followed up on: increasing the accuracy and precision of missiles and making them precision guided is an issue that concerns all countries with missile technology. Iran, which is in close competition with the world's missile powers, is also trying to find a fitting place for itself in this competition. The first generation of the Shahab missiles had a 500-meter circular error probability. After tireless efforts by Iranian engineers to optimize them, they reached a 150-meter circular error probability in the Shahab 3 missile using a fully indigenous guidance and control technology called Shahid Ghazi. This was a significant improvement in the missile's precision, but efforts did not stop there. Engineers continued to work hard to lower the circular error to less than 10 meters. The result of years of efforts in the field of missiles with pinpoint accuracy paid off when Fateh 110, one of the most advanced and fastest surface-to-surface missiles in Iran, was introduced. The Fateh 110 is extremely precise, with a circular error of probability of less than 10 meters. Deploying and preparing this missile for firing in the shortest possible time has made it impossible to track before it is launched. The four different classes of the Fateh missile guarantee our victory in any possible war. After achieving pinpoint accuracy in missiles, the constant presence and threatening posture of U.S. warships in the Persian Gulf led Iranian scientists to consider the development of missiles capable of striking moving targets. The idea was not far-fetched given Iran's astonishing advances in its missile industry. The Khalij Fars, or Persian Gulf missile, can track and destroy anything that moves in the azure waters of the Persian Gulf due to its supersonic speed and the utilization of cutting-edge technology in guidance and the capability to lock on its target. This missile, which is from the Fateh 110 generation and is designed to hunt down enemy ships, has a range of 300 kilometers and provides security for the entire Persian Gulf. The Hormuz precision-guided missiles come in two classes and use supersonic speed. The Hormuz 1 is designed to destroy the radar of enemy ships by using a radar signal interception system. The Hormuz 2 has a higher destructive power and is designed to destroy ships. These two missiles complement one another, and when used together, they can turn into a nightmare for warships operated by enemies of Iran in the Persian Gulf. If military experts and theorists considered the 2000s to be the renaissance and flourishing period of Iran's missile power, the most important reason for this astonishing progress is the sheer volume of the increased threats of the U.S. in this decade. Threats that don't change even when U.S. presidents do.
All options are obviously on the table, as the president has said repeatedly.
Very clear. The president of the United States doesn't take any options off the table.
For our part, the United States is keeping all options on the table.
And as the president has said,
all options are on the table.
Even though the U.S. fleet casually cruises in the Persian Gulf and American troops are on standby in bases near Iranian borders, their direct and indirect threats will never see the light of day. Because they are well aware that regardless of all their threats, there is a powerful reciprocal threat called Iran's missile capability.
From the early 1990s, while engineers were trying to establish Iran's missile industry by working on different projects, the leaders of the country's missile program were also thinking about developing a different kind of military defense strategy. The creation of underground missile cities under the vast lands of Iran was a strategy that would have important deterrence effects, especially in the years to come. It would not take long for the enemy to realize the power of Iran's missile industry and seek to destroy it in order to disarm Iran. So, it was necessary to keep this industry out of their reach, somewhere far away and at the same time very near, somewhere the enemy can't reach and at the same time its threat level is reduced. Missile cities were expanding every year alongside the advance of the missile industry. The future would prove how intelligent the policy to build these cities was. The Qiyam missile was unveiled in 2010 and came as a surprise to the enemies because it showed that Iran had gone far beyond their imagination. With a range of 700 kilometers, Qiyam was the first missile in Iran without fins, equipped with an improved guidance system and designed to counter the threats of U.S. bases in the region. This rapid missile can not only be fired from underground silos, but also has a variety of launch pads. The Emad missile was unveiled in 2015 and showcased that Iranian scientists and experts are still in pursuit to discover and invent new products and mechanisms to reach more ambitious goals. Their creative spirit relentlessly went from one project to another to test untaken paths and showcase a new product to the world each time. The design and production of the Emad missile was a giant leap forward in Iran's missile industry.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee have pledged to deploy 100,000 attorneys and volunteers to monitor the upcoming presidential vote next November. Democrats and election experts say that figure is unrealistic and have expressed concern the effort could hamper normal election operations and intimidate American voters. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican National Committee and former President Donald Trump's campaign announced a new initiative on Friday, 19th of April, to deploy thousands of monitor vote counting in battleground states during the presidential election. The Republican Party aims to recruit 100,000 volunteers to observe the voting process and report irregularities, as well as lawyers to provide rapid response services if there are issues in vote counting. The Republican National Committee is hiring hundreds of election integrity staff across the map, more than ever before, because our party will be recruiting thousands of more observers to protect the vote in 2024, according to Lara Trump, Republican National Committee co-chair, in a press release. Lara Trump added, "These campaign officials in states are tasked with recruiting, training, and when possible, shifting poll watchers and poll workers day in and day out." The operation plans to set up an election integrity hotline in every battleground state and create a command center for lawyers to respond to reports from volunteers. There will also be monthly training sessions on monitoring voting sites and ballot counting centers, according to the press release. The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee are calling it the most extensive and monumental election integrity program in the nation's history. "Every jurisdiction in the country allows people to observe, but not interfere, with the voting and counting process," according to David Becker, CBS News election law contributor and the founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David Becker doubts that Republicans will be able to attract as many volunteers for the effort as they have claimed. "Transparency in elections is a good thing," David Becker said, "but I don't recall a single presidential election in recent memory where there weren't promises of recruiting an army of thousands of poll watchers, and those have never materialized." The program was designed by the Trump campaign, along with newly installed Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Whatley, Lara Trump, and Republican National Committee Chief Counsel Charlie Spies. Before Trump selected him to the chair of the Republican National Committee, Michael Whatley worked on election integrity initiatives as the chair of the North Carolina Republican Party. His history with these efforts was a motivating factor for Donald Trump when he selected him to succeed Ronald McDaniel as party chair. The announcement underscores an effort by former President Trump to refocus the Republican National Committee on election integrity, which Trump felt previous party leaders failed to accomplish during the 2020 presidential election. Despite Donald Trump's focus on the issue, there was no evidence of widespread fraud during the 2020 presidential election. Trump is currently facing federal and state charges relating to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The Democratic National Committee, the DNC, accused the Trump political operation of trying to undermine the results of the 2024 presidential election. Donald Trump knows he's running a losing campaign, so he's working with his hand-picked team of election deniers at the Republican National Committee to once again lay the groundwork to undermine our democracy and spread baseless lies about a rigged election. According to Alex Floyd, the Democratic National Committee Rapid Response Director. The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered